All right, it seems like a long time since we had a regular class because we've had some commercial breaks the last 2 weeks. But we are going to look at Judges chapters 6 and 7 today. As much as we are able, we're going to spend some time talking about Gideon, one of the more well-known. He's not perhaps as well-known as Samson was, but he's not as obscure as Othniel, who you probably never heard of before this class. So we'll open up to Judges 6. Now that we're back in the church, I'm not printing out the sheets again, but there are Bibles in back if you didn't bring your own Bible with you. The Bibles that we had, somebody asked me a while back about, we pulled the pew Bibles, and what was that all about? We don't have enough to really spread throughout the church. A lot of them were beat up, and they had just seen better days. And now we have this translation update thing, where there's the new NIV, which, 95%+ of it is an improvement. It's good. But then there's some of these key verses that I just think they messed up. And the gender neutral thing is going through the whole translation, and where a masculine singular pronoun he gets changed to they. And I think we're not that PC at St. Mark's to be worried about offending people by using a generic he. So I don't like that about it, but at the same rate, many kind, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that's what English is doing. So we haven't pulled the trigger on buying the new NIV because there's two things going on. One is that there is a Wells translation project going on called the Wartburg Project, which some, including recently retired professor Dr. Brug, who is like, if you've ever met Brug, he's like five brains have been instilled into his head. The man is insanely brilliant. he's heading up the Old Testament side of the project. So there's that, but to me, the more interesting is the Holman Christian Standard Bible, HCSB, sometimes called the Hardcore Southern Baptist Bible, HCSB, put together by Southern Baptists, but they're planning a revision in a few years from now. And they really want this Bible to not be the Hardcore Southern Baptist Bible. They really want it to be used by all confessing Christians, especially since the NIV kind of dropped the ball in its update. Now people are starting to look elsewhere. Where's a good translation we can use? We have a standing translation committee that talks to other translation groups out there. And our committee has given many suggestions to the Holman translation, and they have taken up every one of them. They are very serious about the suggestions that we have given them. And so when this update comes out in a few years, and they're going to drop the Holman, the word Holman is to Southern Baptists what the word Northwestern is to Wells Lutherans. It used to be the Northwestern Lutheran, we have Northwestern College, and we have Northwestern Publishing House. So they're going to drop the word Holman and just call it the Christian Standard Bible when the update comes out. And it looks like this could be very ecumenically accepted. In other words, this is not just going to be a Southern Baptist thing, but it's going to be a good enough, a fine translation to the point where confessing traditional Christians across denominations are going to say, hey, we like this translation. And there's something to be said for that, so that we don't have our Wells sect translation. You know what I mean? Like the Jehovah's Witnesses have the New World Translation, and it's their translation, and if they don't like, they adjust it in the Bible. We don't want to be known as the Lutherans that have their sect translation. So if there can be a really solid translation that's ecumenically used, that there's something attractive to that. And so we're kind of dragging our feet intentionally, which is why we're not spreading them out to the pews because we don't have enough in good condition to do that, and why we're kind of going with pick one up in the cabinets and back until we really know for sure what we want to use in the long term. That's the Wartburg project, yeah. That the group is doing that, and that's also intriguing. I'll have a copy on my shelf, no doubt. I'm a little cautious about this is our translation and nobody else's. That's what concerns me a little bit. So, but it's still a worthy project, and I look forward to it being completed. That's anyway why we're still using the old NIVs the way we are in back. So make sure to grab a copy when you come in. Sorry for a tangent that we're already running late here. We're in Judges chapter 6 today. I'm hoping that you're previewing the sections. It's been 3 weeks since we met, so I don't know if chapters 6 and 7 were on your mind during the course of the week. But there's a lot to read here, and so I would rather us take a moment to kind of skim through it as we answer the questions. So rather than read it in advance, have you on your own in the pews here read through it as we're looking to answer the questions. And initially, what do you know about Gideon? Without looking at the Bible translation, anything come to your mind about the name Gideon, or other than it's been a while? Pardon? The Gideons, okay. The Bibles that we steal out, borrow out of the hotel room, okay. They're always King James though, so if you like King Jimmy, it's that's no relation though. That's Joshua, yeah. But see, but you're proving my point. What do we know about Gideon? We know his name, and that's about it. Steve.
He was a warrior, reluctantly, we'll put it that way, to come out and defend Israel.
Okay, so we'll notice he's a reluctant warrior, Ed.
His army was too big.
His army was too big. We'll come across that one today. Those two points are points that we'll come across as we study today. Let's look at the study guide for Judges chapter 6. Notice the repeating pattern, verses 1 through 6. Notice the repeat pattern. I will read verses 1 through 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. So Gideon rids them of the Midianites. The Midianites were descendants of Abraham. So these are also, to some degree, relatives of Israel. When Abraham's wife Sarah died, he married a woman named Keturah. And she had a son, and it's this bloodline that are the Midianites. So these are half-siblings, if you will, to the nation of Israel. But they weren't nice half-siblings. Two, because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, who were to the southeast, and the Amalekites, who were to the south, and other eastern peoples, so they were kind of getting a 90-degree attack from three groups, or multiple groups, I should say. They invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. Does this sound familiar? This is the start of the repeating pattern again, where we had peace now after the last judge, after Deborah and Barak, and now there's peace for an extended period of time. Israel starts to wander away from God because things are good again, and they forget who gives them these good gifts. And so now he allows a group of foreign nations to invade the land and cause them trouble, and they cry out to God for help. Verses 1 through 6 are mentioned in the study guide. I think we summarized that by what we read. What's interesting is question number 1. God sent a prophet to Israel in verse 7 and following. God sends a prophet to Israel. What was the prophet's message? Go ahead on your own and read through. What was essentially, in your own words, the message that the prophet had for the people of Israel? When you got it, raise your hand so Mike can give you a mic. So it points out God's blessings to them in the past. What else does the prophet say to them? I'm sorry. You're not following me again, which is what Mary said up here. You said they're not listening. This is just the same repeated pattern, and he calls them on it. He doesn't just deliver them, because if he just delivers them, are they really brought to repentance? No. So he has to call them to repentance, get them to realize that what they've fallen into the same pattern as their forefathers again. The end of verse 10. Or verse 10, I say to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me. So they're falling into, they're breaking the first commandment, the first and most important commandment. So they get a prophet who's kind of like their John the Baptist. He tells them primarily a law message that they're not real fun, they're not real fond of hearing. Now we get to question two. When the Lord came to Gideon, he was reluctant to accept this call. So this is what I think Steve said earlier. He was kind of a reluctant warrior. We find Gideon making objections. This kind of reminds me of Moses when Moses was called to serve. That, I'm kind of slow of speech, and I'm not sure I can do this, and how will Pharaoh believe me? So you get the same kind of thing from Gideon. Gideon says in verse 13, is the Lord really with us? And God says what in verse 14? Or the angel of the Lord says what in verse 14? This is like dealing with children, right? Do I really have to go? Clean your room! He's just, come on, Gideon, let's get this done. Verse 15, Gideon complains that he's from the weakest clan in Israel, and maybe he was, but the angel of the Lord's objection was, or response was,
I will be with you.
I'm with you. If the angel of the Lord, who is Christ, God, he's God. The angel of the Lord is God. This is Christ before he is a human being. The angel of the Lord, these angel of the Lord references in the Old Testament are Christ showing up, the Son of God. Remember, angel has a much broader definition in the Bible than our popular definition of angel. Our popular definition, God to be a messenger, or my mother says this to people, especially the waitress, if she likes the waitress. Oh, you're an angel. Which means what? You're a nice person. It's like I said in the sermon, you're a saint. We use the word saint kind of that same way popularly. But angel really means messenger. So the messenger of God, well, somebody coming with a message from God the Father, that could very well be, and it is, God the Son. So the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, more often than not, is not a created angel, but actually the Son of God. And you can see that from what the angel says, like, am I not with you? A created angel saying that versus God saying that means something different. Another thing is you can sense from the reaction that they have when they realize they've been dealing with the angel of the Lord. You'll see that from Gideon in just a moment. Verse 17, Gideon asks for a sign. What happens? Well, we should probably read to get this one. Verse 17, Gideon replied, if I have now found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you. And the Lord said, I will wait until you return. So Gideon's not really sure that he's dealing with the real thing. So he wants to see his security badge. Gideon went in and prepared a young goat from and from an ephah of flour he made bread without yeast. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. The angel of God said to him, Take the meat and unleavened bread and place them on this rock and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. So did he get a sign? Yeah. Big time. 22. When Gideon realized that it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, Ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. Why is that a big deal?
You don't get to see God every day.
You don't see God and live. You don't see God and live. When Moses was on top of Mount Sinai and he asked to see God, what did God say? You can, and this is mysterious to us. We don't really get it, which is cool with me that I don't get it. But He said, I'll pat, you know, you can see my back, but you can never see, you can't see my face. And then when he came down the
And so building onto it wasn't going to work so well either. So in the early 1920s, they started a search for some new land.
I'm calling him to be God's prophet. What does Isaiah say about the Lord? About seeing the Lord. Remember? Woe to me, I am ruined, for I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among the people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord God Almighty. So you don't see, you know, seeing God face to face is a bit of a terrifying, I mean, it's easy for us to talk about this academically, but if this actually happened to you, I don't think we'd take it real lightly. You know, I think we'd take this pretty seriously. And Gideon certainly did, after his hemming and hawing and uncertainty, now he realizes that he's actually dealt with the angel of the Lord, and he equates the angel of the Lord to God. So the Jews got this. In some ways, we're so culturally removed from this concept that there's God and the Son of God, and the Son of God is God. You know, to us, it's like mathematically impossible. How does that work? The Jews got this. This was ingrained in their religious thinking, and so Gideon shows that because he says, "Ah, I've seen the Lord." He speaks to God, and he's frightened because he's seen the Lord. But notice verse 23. But the Lord said to him, "Peace, do not be afraid. You are not going to die." And Gideon responds by building an altar. Number three, the Lord wanted Gideon to clean up his own house before he set out to deliver Israel. How was Gideon supposed to do this? Look at verse 25 and following. What happens? Get rid of Baal. Tell me more. Yes, tell me more. What God was his family worshiping? He's worshiping the false god Baal and Asherah, the male and female components of this fertility cult. And you can imagine what their worship involved if it was a fertility cult. So this was what the people, you know, this is not just a generic complaint. God says, "Oh, you've drifted away and you're worshiping the gods of the Amorites." They have their own, if you will, altar, their own worship environment that they have built for themselves to these false fertility gods. And so Gideon's job is to get rid of it and to cut this down. What's all involved with what Gideon does? Read through, glance through it, and see what he's doing. So he cuts down the Asherah pole, which was a, if you will, an object of worship, and the false altar. And what else does he do? He builds a new altar to the true God. The rule of thumb was uncut stones, right? When does he do this? Why? Why? This is religion. How does religious differences in the Middle East, how do they go these days? It wasn't all that different. It wasn't all that different then. The idea imagine if a Christian cut down some statue or something in a mosque in the Middle East today, and it was discovered who it was. How do you think that would go? Yeah, you're looking at the guillotine really soon. John's got a point in the back.
When you read what the scripture is saying, it almost sounds like Gideon's father has the town's altar to Baal. It wasn't just like a bunch of people in town each had an altar to Baal, but it was like the worship place of Baal and Asherah. And so when Gideon tore this down, it would be like tearing down the town worship center.
Yeah, because it's not just his family that's upset, is it? There's a whole bunch of people that are upset that he went ahead and did this at night, and they think, so he does this at night because this is not going to be a popular move. But when it's discovered, you can see that there's more than just the family that's upset. Joyce has got a comment, and then Ed. For the record, both switches have to be on. Go ahead, Joyce.
Right, the bulls, the animals that they have, the second, Joyce says she's got a note, and I came across that in my preparation, and one of the study Bibles had that point, that the bull that was offered in sacrifice to God, the true God, was the bull that the Baal cult used to fertilize the other, yeah, exactly. I don't know what the terminology is, I'm sorry. This is not something I talk about every day of the week. So this was, you know, this was the fertile male bull that they just killed. So that says something to what was happening to Baal worship by Gideon's action.
Oh, that was my question too.
Okay, all right, same thing. Great minds think alike. So this marks for Gideon's family. He's saying we're ending this Baal worship. We're returning to the worship of the God of Israel, the true God, by doing this. But this caused a lot of consternation. Four, how did Gideon's father show a renewed faith fostered by his son's fearlessness? Because the people want Gideon dead. When you have a religious disagreement in the Middle East, the answer usually is murder. And there's no different here. But how does Gideon's Baal-worshipping dad give a much more healthy response? Page ahead in the chapter. Elaine has got... If there are mic problems, or if we don't get a mic to you, I'll just do my best to repeat, so... So the father's answer was, if you're all worked up about the God you worship, let him take care of things himself. It's not a big deal. In fact, Gideon gets a nickname. What was his nickname in the chapter? Jerubbaal? Is that what it is? Yeah. Jerubbaal. And what it literally means is to contend with Baal, or to war with Baal, or to battle with Baal. Let him, if Baal's got an issue, let Baal contend with him. So let him contend with Baal. Let him have his argument with Baal. So he gets this warrior nickname, which is ironic because he was kind of a chicken from the start. And we'll see that personality continue to play through as the account goes through. Even after the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon and led him to muster Israel's troops, Gideon still had reservations. How did the Lord help Gideon overcome them? This is probably the thing that we know the most about Gideon. You remember now? What was it?
300.
We're not there yet. That's next chapter.
That's coming too, yeah. But what Gideon is still chicken. You know, he's had his little argument with God, and then God, the angel of the Lord, accepts the sacrifice, and then he kind of snaps out of his being chicken. But he's getting chicken again. What does God do to help him with his chicken?
He has a second sign by putting the fleece on the wool and having to do.
So he asks for two signs. He's got this wool fleece, and he leaves the fleece out at night. It's dry, so there shouldn't be dew on the ground, but he asks that the fleece be have dew on it in the morning. And what does God do? Exactly what he requests. Was that enough? I need one more. Just one more, God. This is like listening to my kids at night trying to not go to bed. Can I tell another story? Oh, I have to brush my teeth now. What do you care about brushing your teeth? You never care in the morning, but you care at night and you want to go to bed. You're supposed to go to bed. So one more. So then he asks for the fleece to be dry and the ground to be wet, which is actually even more unnatural, because what would the fleece naturally do?
absorb, right? So the ground is wet with dew, which is not something they would have expected that time, at that point, but the fleece was dry. So both mild miracles, you know, nobody's gonna, this is not like raising somebody from the dead, but this is not something that should normally happen. And so both of these signs are meant to assure Gideon, even though he's being hesitant, even though God could rightly say, I've already called you, I've already told you, why are you being hesitant? He still encourages him in his unbelief and his uncertainty. Application question number 6. I kind of want to change this question. The question is, why is it important to destroy the idols in our hearts if we are to be successful in carrying out the Lord's work? Obviously, if God is not number one, the way we put ourselves forward to God's work is not going to be with a full heart either. If I were writing the study guide, the application question that comes to my mind is how does God deal with us? And you know, God was very patient with Gideon. How many second signs and second chances does he get? You know, he bickers with at least 3 exchanges earlier in the chapter, 3 that are recorded, and who knows how many that maybe not are not recorded. And then later on, we get this whole fleece thing. He gets 2 more signs. You know, God could have just said, I called you, you were supposed to do this. You're not doing it, you're out. But he's exceedingly patient. How can you see God being exceedingly patient in our lives today? Can you find parallels of that personally or at large, with the church at large? What's the condition of the church in America right now?
Lethargic.
Mike gave me a thumbs down. Okay, not reading the scriptures too much. I visited a lot of, I don't have opportunities to go church spying like I once did, but I've gone to many a service where the Bible is never read. I know some of you are, really? My wife, I would tell these things to Emily, and she'd say, you've got to be kidding me, and you've got to come along and see this stuff. And then she did once, and okay, I guess you're right. Music to my ears. She's probably right more than I am, but don't tell her I said that. Mike.
To my tradition, it's abortion and homosexuality.
Okay, then these are accepted in the church.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the church term. I guess in the church of accepting and intolerance.
Okay, so that these things are accepted, that homosexuality, that abortion are... did you see the news article? It was all over social media of the female clergy in support of Planned Parenthood.
Blessing
some local Planned Parenthood. You know, what should God do at this point? And before we pick on the world too much, how much are we evangelizing these days? You got a lot of neighbors that you know that need to know Jesus. When's the last time you had a conversation with them? I'm looking at myself and saying the same thing. I'm not just picking on you. I'm thinking, There's a couple people that I'm rarely talking with, and the percentage of my conversations that get to the gospel are pretty low.
But Pastor, I have talked to these people, so why should I bother?
But Mary, this is a game. This is not. I know from your tone that you're representing an answer, and Mary now represent everybody. So. But Mary, we sin and sin and sin and sin and sin against God, and how often does He forgive us, right? You know, I mean, that's the answer that we need to hear in those circumstances, right? Somebody said lethargic early on, and I think that's a good description. It becomes we get very comfortable, even as things are going, well, okay, that's just the way it is. The world is getting nasty, and God is very patient with us, probably more than He should be. I mean, in the business world, if things are lethargic, you don't last very long. So it's a good thing to remember that for us individually, to see when you leave the church and you see that mission statement, that that's not the corporation statement. That's your statement. It's not the statement for the corporation, St. Mark's Evangelical Lutheran Church and School of Citrus Heights, copyright whatever. That's your personal statement also. And we blow it very often. And yet God continues to be patient with us and continues to encourage us. And you know what? Eventually what happens? Eventually that neighbor that you, oh, I'm going to have that conversation one of these days. Eventually you do have the conversation. And maybe you make some progress. And maybe you get them here to church or whatever it happens to be. God doesn't give up on us. And therefore we need to remember that not to be too critical of these heroes of faith in the past like Gideon, because yeah, you see a lot of negatives, but I see myself in those negatives too. I'm gonna keep moving, flip the page over. Judges chapter 7. Part of the reason I'm not having us read this, well, there's two reasons I'm not having us read this section in advance. One is it's a very lengthy section, but the other is some of these questions work better if you have to look them up rather than if we've already read them and then you're answering then the question seems like it's a second grade question. So I'm hoping these questions work a little bit better if you are spending time reading through on your own. But that's also a reminder to read through in advance if at all possible. We'll do chapters 8 and 9 next time. Chapter 7. So now we're finally getting, after all this hemming and hawing, Gideon finally goes into battle. And what's the problem that we encounter at the start of chapter 7 with Jerubbaal / Gideon? What's God's complaint? The army is too big. When have you ever heard of that being a complaint before? The army is too big. Pardon? Oh, in Washington, oh, political. We don't do politics here, except with tangents, which happen far too frequently. Sorry. the army's too big. So God whittles the army down two ways. What's the first way he whittles the army down? Pardon? And what determines whether you leave or not? If you're chicken, go home. Watch the SCA, it'll be fine. So if they were afraid, they just went home. So that's a pretty good deal. Well, that would have lived down more than half. Then God said, we still have too many. So what was the interesting litmus test that they used? We're going to the water fountain, or as we say in Wisconsin, the bubbler. We're going to the river, you're going to take a drink. And what was the criteria for whether or not you went into battle?
How you drank.
Most everybody knelt down and just, you know, drank out of the river. But some palmed it up and then lapped it up like a dog. How many? 300. Those 300. So now you know never how to drink. Because if you drink like that, you get sent into battle. So those 300 were the men chosen to go to war against the Midianites. In one of the commentaries I read, that made the ratio of Israelite soldiers to Midianite soldiers 1 to 450. 1 to 450. Why is God doing this? What is he thinking? How are you going to win? Not by your strength, not by your might. And maybe that's a little bit behind the question that I altered at the bottom of the first page. Why do we have to get rid of the idols in our heart? I think, you know, with idol being not just a false god, but the things that become more important. And sometimes we can be our own idol. The church will not survive without me. Pastors can have that become their idol. If I am not here, this will not go right. If I don't do this, this will not happen. I am so needed and so necessary. And then God, you know, makes sure that something happens to humble you. Or you get a call and the church is vacant. And you know what? The church survives. And they get a new pastor with different talents and the church survives. Sometimes we can be our own idol. We can think that without me, the church is not going to make it. Now, should we offer ourselves in service to God? Yes. I'm not telling you to not offer yourselves in service to the Lord and His church. But if it gets to the point where we think that the church cannot survive without our ideas and our examples and our service, then we become our own idol. And if anyone of the Israelites think that, our great warriors are the reason that we beat the Midianites, God is ridding them of that idol in their minds and in their hearts. By whittling the army down to 300. When we are called to do a difficult task, the Lord is not stingy with encouragement. He knows that we are only flesh and blood, so he helps us. How did he help Gideon? We saw already how he's encouraged Gideon with the sign and then with the miracles of the fleece twice. What happens here? This is something that I had forgotten about until I read through the chapter last week. What happens at verse 13 and following that encourages Gideon here as he's about to go into battle outnumbered 450-1? You know, you know Bible classes now in the 21st century when you see people looking up the verses on their phone. What are you finding? How he snuck into the enemy camp, how this guy who's got chicken syndrome sneaks in there is beyond me. But he sneaks in there and he hears a conversation among the enemies where one of them said he had a dream, and this dream symbolized Israel and Gideon in particular defeating the Midianites. And the person he tells this dream to says, that's it, we're toast. So how is God using this? He's using this in order to encourage Gideon. Okay, I know you just got 300 guys. I know this seems insane, but trust me. Trust me. And God deals with us the same way. I know sometimes this thing, I know to believe and trust me in this circumstance or that circumstance seems crazy. But look at my track record with you, dear Christian. Trust me. And this is the same, we have the same situations in our own ways, in our own lives, and God encourages us to trust him. He gives this encouragement to Midian. There's no subtle interpretation needed to figure out what the dream means here. So how does the battle play out? I think some of you referenced this already. When does the battle take place? I'm not looking for a specific time, the general statement more. Just let's converse. Let's just blurt it out. It happens at night. It happens at night. And what's interesting, one of the commentaries noted that it's happening at a switching of the watchmen. So you've got one group of watchmen that's out cold, sleeping. You've got another group of watchmen that's waiting to go to sleep, and their time is just about up and they can snooze. And you've got another group that's groggy, that's just getting up. So God times this at a strategic time, and then what happens at this strategic time? What do the Israelites do?
They pretend like they're a huge army, but they're really not.
They surround them in a couple of groups of 100 apiece, if I'm remembering correctly, and they break their jars that hid their torches. So this sound must echo through the camp. And then they see on the hills these torches, and if you're about to fall asleep or were sound asleep or groggy and just getting up, what do you think? Yeah, don't say it. Oh boy, are we in trouble. And it's dark, and it's not dark like Sacramento where there's streetlights. It's dark, dark. So what happens to the army? Just say it. If you see somebody with a sword, I don't care who it is. I can't tell who it is. I got to save my own life. So there you go. You pull an Ehud, right? You just slash anybody who's around you, which leads to the final question. Question four: How many Midianites did each Israelite soldier kill? Zero. They turned on themselves, which shows you that who's in charge. Would any Israelite soldier or general have come up with this plan? Good heavens, no. 1 to 450 in the middle of the night. This is insane. But God does this to show them, to lead them to trust him. Because what's their issue? They keep drifting from him. They keep wandering from him. Well, now he's gonna win the victory for them. These guys that kept ravaging their land and killing their flocks and destroying their crops, they're gone again for some time. because the Lord's plan accomplished the victory that they were looking for. Question five. In 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 10, Paul said, "When I am weak, then I am strong." How does this summarize Israel's battle with the Midianites? How does this summarize our own lives? Go ahead, send the mic down. It's in your weakness that you have no choice but to trust God. And sometimes he needs to get us to that humble point so that we realize we have no choice but to trust him. When is faith strongest? When do you turn to him the most in prayer? When things are peachy keen? I'm your pastor, but sometimes I'm a horrible example to my flock because my flock at home, because boy, when's my prayer life really good? When things are really bad. Yeah. Maybe that's why you start me with anxiety, huh? But in all honesty, that drives you to your knees in prayer a lot more than if things are peachy keen. And I can think of how turmoil in members' lives. I think I'm not going to tell the specific situation, but I can think of a specific situation at my former congregation where somebody that I cared about deeply was just in an awful circumstance and just literally led me to my knees in prayer for this person. You know, sometimes when we keep the church doors locked, and for good reason in this neighborhood, but to have the church doors open so that you can come up to that altar and use the cushions to kneel before God in prayer, sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's a good thing, and you do that every now and then when something really bugs you and when something's really on your heart and someone you love is really in turmoil God humbles us, puts us in these situations to drive us back to him in prayer, to drive us back to his word. I've heard that from so many of you, that boy, when I went through this awful thing, that's when I turned to God the most in prayer. And so is our story all that much different from the Israelites? Maybe we're not wandering from them to the point of Baal worship, but we wander from him, and he uses the crosses we have to bring us back to himself. Now, don't overinterpret your crosses. I had a kid when I was in North Hollywood as a vicar, there was a kid in my seventh grade catechism class who I discovered way at the end of the year. When you teach catechism and you do the whole catechism in a year, when do you get to the Lord's Prayer? At the end of the year. And you talk about the phrase, "deliver us from evil." The last petition of the Lord's Prayer, the last thing you cover in catechism. And it came out in conversations that this kid thought that every bad thing that happened to him was God punishing him for a specific thing that he did wrong. Now you and I, nice St. Mark's adult Bible class attending people, know that not to be true until something goes wrong. And then you start to have those self-doubts. I live it too. I will say that I've had those same feelings. Even though up here, I know that's not true, here I have my doubts. Emotionally, I have my doubts. Even though, my faith, my intellect says, you know, it's not true. God does not do this tit for tat stuff. God doesn't operate with karma. Even though our world thinks that we operate with karma. But whether it is simply a cross that comes into our life, or maybe it is a call to repentance, whatever it happens to be, these ultimately drive us back to himself. Gideon's challenge kept driving his uncertainty, his reactions. God continues to be patient with him and loving with him and encouraging toward him so that he finally does see God give him the victory in battle. We've got a couple of minutes. Any comments that you want to make on these two chapters? 1 John and then Pastor Bartelt up here.
One thing that seems interesting about Gideon and the fleece is after he's called the soldiers together, and so by then he's probably picked his generals and captains and things like that, and so you wonder how much of did the Lord really kill you? Once he did the fleece once, then somebody probably said, you know, many of you are imagining, you know, maybe that's happened before. So you always wonder about the counsel of the people around you, and if that sign wasn't as much or more for the other leaders under Gideon as it was for Gideon himself.
No, that's a great point. We have minimal details in these accounts. God the Holy Spirit gave us just enough to know what happened, and nothing more than what we need. But it's interesting to say, obviously more happened, more conversation happened than what's in here. And so I would imagine just about everybody who's advising Gideon is saying, huh? You sure? I think that's an excellent point. Pastor Bartell.
It's interesting you brought up the comment about what's happening back in the Old Testament. People killing themselves for one thing or another. But it's happening today, even as I speak. We live, you know, in a city with a tremendous amount of Sikh East Indians. This weekend is their major celebration. Up to 80,000 to 100,000 Sikhs are invading the city. And they will all be departing tonight.
You want to come over to our house this afternoon? Maybe you want to go bowling today.
You know, all this week in our newspapers, we've had articles about this thing that's coming along, another big parade today. And what kicks off their celebration on Friday night is a huge fireworks celebration, because that's a joyous occasion. They canceled it this year. Because in India, in the Punjab, where most of these Sikhs come from, reactionists against that religion have taken their holy scriptures and ripped them apart, which is a huge, huge, terrible thing for the Sikh. So much so that in the Punjab in India, as we speak, they're killing one another over this situation. Just because they ripped apart what we would call their light. It's happened, and that's how they respond today.
Sure.
Over there.
Yeah.
And this is how our Sikhs are responding to it. We're not going to have this great celebration because we're mourning the situation there.
Sure.
So it's happened.
Yeah, that's part of the reason that I wanted to teach Judges this fall, because I thought, you know, as everybody's been saying lately, boy, our nation's just kind of going down. I thought, well, yeah, it is. And this is nothing new. And you read, and as you go through Judges, it just gets worse. Not to say, you know, it only gets better from here in Bible class, but it really, you know, you see so many parallels to the modern world. And it's sad, but it's also an encouragement to us in this. We're not dealing with anything new. We're not dealing with anything the world hasn't seen. And God, who was with his people then, is still with his people now. That's an encouragement we can take home from that. Please read chapters 8 and 9 again for the sake of time, and because I think the questions work better if we didn't just read it right before, because then they end up being more like second grade questions. Read chapters 8 and 9 for next time, the rest of the Gideon story and then beyond will be in those two chapters, and we'll discuss that next Sunday in class. Have a good week. Thank you.
Speaking of church.